Good morning, Your Honors. I'm David Newdorf. May it please the Court. I'm representing appellants Abdelaziz and Marin Coronel. And with the Court's permission, I wish to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. And as this Court may go directly to the second prong of a qualified immunity analysis, that's where I'm going to start. It's what I believe is the appellant's strongest case, and it's what I'll spend most time on. Question is whether the officers violated any clearly established law or right when they engaged in a high-speed chase of a criminal suspect who lost control of his car and struck and injured innocent bystanders. Then second, I'll address the question of whether there was a clearly established right or clearly established law when officers allegedly failed to summon emergency medical aid after the plaintiffs had been struck and injured by a fleeing criminal suspect.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you a question about the claim of intent to harm, the intent to harm the driver of the vehicle that crashed. And specifically, my question is, there are cases certainly that say if there is a deliberate intent to harm, and that's the sole reason, that would state a claim against an officer. So my question is, what happens in a dual motivation case? There is some legitimate law enforcement purpose, but in addition, the officers have a deliberate purpose to harm. Does that state a claim?
First of all, Your Honor, I have to address two different parts of that because I have a different view than is embedded in the question. First, the justification is the argument of the plaintiffs, and under the Lewis case, under the Lewis case and this court's decisions under the Lewis case, the initial justification of the pursuit is justified by the criminal conduct. So the pursuing a criminal suspect, initiating that pursuit under Lewis and under this court's decisions, it's justified from the outset.
Except that the cases are sort of weirdly in the negative. They say you can't state a claim if there is no intent to harm. But they don't say, at least I don't read them to say, you can't state a claim unless the only purpose is to cause harm.
Your Honor, I don't view this or the analysis of this court as dealing with multiple motivations. They're two separate things.
But this seems to be such a case. As I read the complaint, there's an acknowledgement that there was a law enforcement-related chase that was overdone. I mean, there was, I guess, an alleged traffic violation or something small in this high-speed chase, but that is a law enforcement purpose. But the complaint also says that there was specific intent to harm the suspect, and there are factual material to support that. For example, saying, I hope the driver dies, okay? So I think we're faced with that dual motivation, and I'm not sure what the cases say about it. I'm actually, unsure what the right answer is.
There is no case in this court or any other circuit that I've seen that analyzes a bystander police pursuit injury case under the 14th Amendment as a dual motivation. And the reason for that is, under the Lewis case, the initial pursuit, initiating the pursuit, is justified when you are chasing a criminal suspect. And most of these cases are minor violations, driving recklessly, and then they result in injury. What is the legal issue in this case that has never been decided by the Ninth Circuit or the U.S. Supreme Court is as follows, is Lewis states that intent to injure the suspect is required under the intent to harm standard, which is the Lewis standard.
Right, and that's what's alleged in this case, that there was a specific intent to harm the suspect.
Correct. But the Lewis case was not analyzed as a bystander case. And in the bystander cases, none of them in this court has specifically addressed in this circuit the question of whether in a bystander case, the 14th Amendment requires the plaintiff to allege and prove intent to harm the bystanders, or whether intent to harm the fleeing suspect is sufficient. And that is the legal issue that needs to be decided in this case.
Well, isn't qualified immunity about whether the conduct that the officers are doing is unconstitutional? And if it would be unconstitutional as to the driver, then at least the officers are engaging in unconstitutional conduct. Why is that not the right way to look at it?
Let me give an analogy. There are cases of excessive force that can be brought under the Fourth Amendment, or if there wasn't a seizure involved, it could be brought by a relative, a family member, under the 14th Amendment. And the intents are very different. The 14th Amendment standard is the highest standard for civil liability under Section 1983, an intent to harm. So knowledge that if you intended to harm the fleeing suspect, and the fleeing suspect is the plaintiff, if that's the law, the fact that the fleeing suspect could have stated a claim under the 14th Amendment doesn't mean that the bystanders could state a claim under the 14th Amendment. And in fact, that issue is the very issue that has never been decided in the Supreme Court or this court, but it has been decided in three out-of-circuit cases. And that's the key of the clearly established law. So the three cases that have been established, that have been decided and address this issue of what is the measure of the intent in a bystander claim? Is it the officer's intent as to the plaintiff bystanders, or could it be, can you state a bystander claim without alleging and proving that the officer had an intent to harm the bystanders? And the case, there are three out-of-circuit cases that have specifically addressed this question, and they've all come down on the side that a bystander claim under the 14th Amendment in a police pursuit case requires plaintiffs to allege and prove that the officers intended to harm the bystander plaintiffs. Those three cases, all outside this circuit, are first, the oldest one is Helseth versus Birch, which is a 2001 decision out of the Eighth Circuit.
Counsel, can I ask, so you accept that intent to harm is properly pled in the complaint?
No, because the specific allegation of the complaint is that the officers intended to harm the fleeing suspect. So this is not a case brought by the suspect.
You accept that is properly pled?
I accept that is exactly what the complaint says.
Well, I mean, but you can't just say it. You have to actually plead facts that make that plausible.
That's true, and we're not challenging the plausibility. Okay. The legal issue raised on this is whether...
I just had a question. It pleads that the Oakland officers purposely caused the suspect to lose control of its vehicle and crash into cars. I don't know how... Is there any facts to support... How is that plausible?
Well, they also said that they were satisfied that the driver was injured and hoped he would die.
Right. But that was after he crashed and presumably killed a bunch of people. So I'm just curious, how is that plausible that the officers would purposely cause him to lose control and crash?
And even if this were a case by the fleeing suspect, that allegation is inherently implausible in that the fact the allegation is,
for example,
that
we don't take purposely, that's a mental state. Just because they assert it, you don't accept that. You need facts to prove that. Right?
Yes, and Arguably, Judge Graber has referred to in the complaint is some evidence of malice towards the driver wishing that he would die.
Okay, so we should accept that the officers had intent to harm the defendant. Or, I mean, I forget the defendant's name, the suspect.
And the legal issue decided by the district court that we take issue with is the holding of the district court that, you know, not based on any decision of this circuit or the U.S. Supreme Court, that a bystander plaintiff in a police chase case brought under the 14th Amendment can establish their case without alleging and proving the officers intended to harm the bystander plaintiff. The allegation accepted that there was an intent to harm the fleeing suspect, even though that is an inherently implausible. There is that allegation that Judge Graber referred to. Even though that seems difficult to prove, the legal question is that even enough? Or, as other circuits have held, as other district courts have held, that the bystander plaintiffs to state a 14th Amendment claim must allege an intent to harm the bystander plaintiff.
So I need to ask a question that you're probably going to fight me, because let's just put away the bystanders for a second. Let's just pretend for a second that this is a claim by the suspect, because I'm trying to understand how this Lewis language works. So there's language in Lewis that says only a purpose to cause harm unrelated to the legitimate object of arrest will satisfy the element of arbitrary conduct shocking the conscience. So you just told us that there is a purpose to cause harm that we can assume from the allegations. And I think it's fair that you did, given that say we hope he dies. But can we assume from this complaint that the purpose to cause harm is unrelated to the legitimate object of arrest?
Your Honor, the legitimate object to arrest is decided at the moment they decide face that split-second decision whether or not to chase a fleeing criminal suspect.
Stop you there
and
for
this
a second.
Court,
I know that chases are alleged, and that cases have said that chasing is fine. But this particular complaint talks about chasing without lights or sirens. And then it also says there's a police department policy against turning off your light and siren. So can you tell me why that isn't more conduct than a chase? Why that isn't an additional thing that matters?
And it is also black letter law under Section 1983 cases that violations of departmental policy do not establish constitutional violations.
I agree that is true also.
And in fact, in the Lewis case, there were allegations that the chase did not conform to departmental policy, and nonetheless, it was not a sufficient claim because there was no allegation that there was a intent to harm anyone.
Okay, we have that. So this is my question. We have the intent to harm here. I agree with you that the fact that it's a policy isn't dispositive, but the fact that there's a policy against turning off your light and siren, why doesn't that create an inference that you only do that for a purpose to harm and not for a legitimate reason, law enforcement reason? Can you tell me I agree the policy isn't enough in itself, but does the policy create an inference that they did this in a particularly dangerous way just for the purpose to harm?
The Lewis case, as well as out-of-circuit cases, have all stated that the question of whether a chase is advisable, of whether it conforms to policy, of whether it was negligent, careless, or reckless disregard, does not state a claim under the 14th Amendment. The specific cases that establish the clearly established law, we believe, or at a minimum, establish that it was not clearly established that the police officers violated any clearly established right or law. For example, 2009 case out of the 10th Circuit, Ellis versus Ogden, states, when an officer is in a high-pressure situation where time is of the essence, there must be evidence of a purpose to cause harm unrelated to the legitimate object of the arrest to satisfy the element of arbitrary conduct shocking the conscience. And here's the key point. The legal issue in this case, never decided in this circuit or in the Supreme Court, the estate failed to allege sufficient facts to support an intent to physically harm or worsen the legal plight of the injured party. And since this was
I have a question about the bystander issue. Why doesn't Onassian run counter to your argument? That's our own case from 1999.
Well, first of all, it didn't address the specific issue of, in that case, there was
It said the bystander can recover. And in that case, they didn't, as it turned out, because the activity did not demonstrate the requisite mental state. But it pretty clearly says that a police officer has an obligation to non-suspects in the high-speed chase. So it seems to me that we have clearly established law on that relationship. Now, that doesn't say anything about the merits, just as to them being a proper plaintiff.
I disagree. Onassian, the result in Onassian was based on the facts of that case. Unlike this case, there was no allegation of intent to harm anyone. The ruling of Onassian, was that Lewis controls bystander cases. Again, in the Lewis case, there was no allegation of the officer's intent to harm either a fleeing suspect or
That's the merits of the case on Onassian.
No, that's the legal issue. That is the legal issue.
They started with whether the non-suspect could sue, basically. And the answer was yes, if the behavior shocks the conscience. And then the court said, well, it doesn't shock the conscience, so they lose. But it did establish, it seems to me, the principle that if you do show something that shocks the conscience, that is, you meet the intent to harm test, that a bystander can recover. I guess I don't understand how you read it differently than that.
Your Honor, because cases stand for the facts and the facts necessary to support the judgment. There's no case that is addressed.
Well, we have a reasonable dicta rule in our court that actually says that if there's language in a case that's reasoned, it is binding whether it was necessary to the holding or not.
But it's not even dicta in the sense that three circuit courts, not including this one, have decided that the intent to harm is directed to the plaintiff.
That doesn't really answer the question of what Onassian means. And to me, it seems maybe even necessary to say that these people can state a claim and then we examine the claim. It wouldn't make sense to say we're going to look at whether it shocks the conscience if they can't even be plaintiffs. So regardless of whether you view it as reasoned dictum or as a holding, our circuit seems to have a different view than the other ones. So I want you to assume for the purpose of this question that Onassian stands for what I'm asserting. And other circuits have a completely different view. In terms of an officer who works in this circuit, isn't Ninth Circuit law, if it's clear, the clearly established law that they're deemed to have to follow?
That does state qualified immunity. That clearly established relies on controlling authority, which would be the Ninth Circuit or the Supreme Court.
Right.
Yet I disagree that
I understand you read Onassian differently than I do.
As did the trial court here, believed that the issue was, and it decided against the officers, that issue as viewed in the trial court is, can a bystander plaintiff state a 14th Amendment claim absent an allegation of intent, allegation and proof of an intent to harm the plaintiff bystander?
So, and we have de novo review, correct?
Pardon?
We have de novo review, do we not?
You do. It's a purely legal issue.
This is why I was focused on, let's put aside the bystander and pretend that it's the driver. I'm trying to figure out this shocks the conscience question that Onassian went to. Here, is your argument that once there is any reason for a chase, there can never be conduct in the chase that shocks the conscience?
That it only shocks the conscience if there is an intent to harm the plaintiff, whether that plaintiff
be... Let's pretend the plaintiff is the driver and answer my question. Is there conduct that can be shocking the conscience in a chase that has a law enforcement purpose but has other things going on with it that somehow could shock the conscience? Is there such a case?
Then the answer is yes. And there has not been a case that found police officers. There's only been a couple of cases out of circuit that have ever found police officers potentially liable to a bystander.
Okay, I want you to pretend the plaintiff is the suspect, and let's just talk about shocking the conscience of the chase, the conduct of the chase. So you said that there can be such a bad chase that it would shock the conscience.
Yes. As stated in Lewis, as stated in Onassian, as stated in the Bing with the Bingay case, shock the conscience in a 14th Amendment police pursuit case means that you satisfy the highest level of intent, which is intent to harm the driver. Your question was limited to a fleeing suspect. So the fleeing driver, there would have to be intent to harm the fleeing driver. But the whole issue is, what's the measure of the officer's intent when it's a bystander case? And that was the issue as viewed by the trial court below, which found that a bystander...
But we're on de novo review, so we don't care what the trial court below... Tell us what the right answer of... I mean, it doesn't matter what the trial court below thought.
The right answer is the answer drawn by both circuits in multiple cases that have looked at the specific issue of intent and bystander claims, and that's the Third Circuit and the Tenth Circuit, both of which have held in more than three cases that when the plaintiff is an injured, innocent bystander, the measure of the officer's intent necessary to shock the conscience under the 14th Amendment is the intent toward the plaintiff. In the bystander case, it's the intent towards the bystander that matters. That was the issue decided in the court below, which
I think we're going around in circles now. I'm going to cut you off your time. I'll still give you 2 minutes for rebuttal, but let's hear from the other side.
Back so soon. good morning again. May it please the court, Pat Buelma for the estate of Lilo Money Esolakai. Your Honor, this is a case where two officers intended to harm a person without the object of arrest, which is the beginning and end of story in regards to how the court should decide. And the reason being is Lewis.
So sorry, I need to stop you there. So I don't know that arrest is the only legitimate law enforcement purpose that someone could ever have. So they may or may not have had a reason for arrest, but the chase had a legitimate law enforcement purpose, yes?
It could have a legitimate law, correct. It could have been for a legitimate law enforcement purpose. And if you're asking about what I'm anticipating is the dual motive, can there be an object, a reason for a law enforcement chase that also has a purpose to harm? And would that still state a claim if there's both? Is that what sort of you're getting at, which was how you opened the last? And the answer is yes. And the reason why we know that is because in Lewis, the court cited to Checkey v. Webb, the Fifth Circuit appellate case, to say, here's an example of where a purpose to harm would be able to survive, would be viable. And in Checkey v. Webb, three troopers were following two suspects without their lights and sirens on. And then they went at high speed. So now the suspect's driving recklessly. And then at some later point in the chase, the two officers finally turned on their lights and sirens They lose sight of the suspect. Later, the suspects get stopped at a roadblock. Officers get out of their car, arrest them. One gets pistol whips one of the plaintiffs. The other one doesn't get pistol whipped. And the court said there, the Fifth Circuit said, and the Supreme Court cited to as a case of purpose to harm, this is a case that would be able to proceed, and it did, and the Fifth Circuit did uphold it as a due process violation. That's a case where they did have the dual motive. They had a reason to stop him, but they couldn't.
It already happened in that case, right?
That didn't happen yet. So
I thought you said they
were gave chase.
He stopped at a checkpoint, and then
they caught up to him
after he was arrested.
Yeah, but the court analyzed was the chase, and I could read from it, but was the chase, the way that they did the chase, would that call into question the motive of the officers? And they said the factual, and I'm just going to quote, the factual development in this case could lead a jury to question whether Webb and Allison's car chasing actions were inspired by malice rather than merely careless or unwise excessive zeal, so that it amounted to an abuse of official power that shocks the conscience. So the court found it on the car chase shocked the conscience, not the actions afterwards. And the passenger also said had a claim based off the car chase, even though the passenger wasn't injured.
What's wrong with the car chase in that case? It just seemed like a legitimate car chase.
It wasn't a legitimate car chase because the officer had their lights and sirens off and were pulling up so close to the suspects that they thought it was a criminal trying to hurt them. And that was the testimony. So it was the manner in which they didn't let the suspects know that they were police and trying to pull them over. And essentially what Lewis said, inducing lawlessness, recklessness, and terrorizing, which is precisely what we have here. We have two officers in a much worse case, two officers that without their license.
This isn't a Fifth Circuit case that's mentioned in a Supreme Court case.
As an example of what would survive a due process claim.
I'm just wondering, would that create clearly established law? Because are all those facts and that process in the case, is that in Lewis? Or was it a simple citation to?
It was a simple citation summarizing the intentional misuse of a vehicle being a basis for a due process claim, which is right here, right? No lights and sirens, using a car to induce lawlessness, terrorize, and cause harm. We have two officers here that did much worse. They terrorized by not using their sirens, not using their lights. And not only did that happen, when the person crashed, they saw that the suspect and the bystanders were injured. They then didn't even stop to do any sort of arrest or therefore any
I just wanted to, so your position, it would be that a footnote in Lewis creates clearly established law referring to another case.
That and Lewis itself. Lewis is a passenger who brought the claim. Not even the driver himself. Lewis says the exception to the rule of immunity for car chases that proves it to be true. The exception is if a plaintiff can show that the officer had an intent to harm. So it says the car chase was initiated for whatever good reason they can claim, but if there's an intent to harm that's shown unrelated to the object of arrest, then that plaintiff, so Lewis itself says it on behalf of a passenger who was not the person that they were after, says there's a claim here. Therefore, Lewis is good. Onassian v. Block is also put someone in Onassian v. Block. The language is outright clear.
Yeah.
A police officer deciding whether to, if a police officer is justified in giving chase, that justification insulates the officer from constitutional attack, irrespective of who might be harmed or killed as a consequence of the chase. If you flip that and say if they're not justified, right, in the way and they show a purpose to harm, then they anyone that's harmed as a result of that malicious intent, they're liable for. And I would just
if you assume that those statements in Onassio is dicta, can dicta? I know we have the Ninth Circuit, binding dicta rule, which is an outlier everywhere. But is there any case that says that dicta can be clearly established law?
So yes, because it's saying the exact same. It's holding what it's holding. Meaning, if you're saying like, let's say for example, let's take an excessive force case. If the trial court says, look, using a taser on someone in this circumstances would be unlawful, right? So then someone comes with under a certain set of circumstances. Then you have a case right after where an officer shot under those same circumstances. Deadly force, right?
Yes.
That would be the taser case would be clearly established law to say, hey, look, you can't even use a taser on this guy, much less can you use excessive force. It'd be clear.
You're fighting the hypothetical of it being dicta, right? Because in your example, that's precise holding of the first case and not the second case. But do an example where the first case is purely dicta, and then does that provide the proper notice to create clearly established law in the second case?
Well, I guess I would have to.
I know it's a harder hypothetical to draw.
The hypothetical is kind of so open. I'm not sure what you want me to do.
I'm just saying, assuming that Onacio, those statements are very helpful to you, I agree, are dicta. How does that provide clearly established law? How does that provide notice to officers? Because, you know, when officers understand the case and they realize that that's not the precise holding of the case, because in that case there was no intent to harm, then how are they supposed to know, you know, read beyond that and say, oh, I can't, you know, harm to anyone can matter?
Well, Your Honor, to be quite frank, Zion v. County of Orange, as well as, I'll remember in a second, as well as AD versus California Highway Patrol, they say if you meet the purpose to cause harm standard itself, that in and of itself does not allow for qualified immunity. Because the standard is basically saying the officer's knowingly violating the law, right? The qualified immunity only applies to people that are doesn't apply to people that are incompetent or knowingly violating the law. Right. To meet the purpose to cause harm standard, you're admitting that the officer knowingly violated the law.
Well, there's also a question of what constitutes dicta. Because, for example, in a qualified immunity situation, if we were to hold in a given case that a certain pattern of conduct is a constitutional violation and then go on to say it was not clearly established. Technically, we didn't have to do that first part. We could just say we can assume it, but it wasn't clearly established. Is that first statement dictum or a holding about what constitutes constitutional violation?
Saying if the court reached...
If the court reaches several issues and you could theoretically avoid deciding one in the chain of the reasoning, does that make the avoidable one dictum, or does it just make it another holding?
It makes it another holding because you have to look at the decision in whole and any reasonable inferences from it. So it's not, that's what I was saying, is to me it feels like saying, if you say the taser can't be used in this situation, well, then you come back and you say, oh, well, but the guy shot with a gun, so he didn't know that he couldn't shoot the guy with a gun, but he shot him with a taser. So,
well, what if he came back and he used a billy club?
Yeah, and which is intermediate force, equal force. So then, exactly, that's a great example.
Exactly.
No, that's my point.
You think?
Yeah, I think that's definitely clear.
What about if he used pepper spray?
Those are all intermediate forces. So
you think the taser case would govern pepper spray?
Yes, because the court has already classified it as intermediate force.
But that's not this case.
We're talking about hypotheticals, obviously. I don't think the court has to reach it. Anyways.
We clearly have a rule that if you intend to harm the suspect, you are liable for damages for that suspect. But it's not necessarily the case. Why would you be on notice that you're also liable for everything else that happens? Because that's a separate question of liability, and that would change officers' actions ex ante.
Well, two reasons. One, Onassian Being and Moreland all said bystanders can recover if the officer shows intent to harm.
Sure. Okay. So,
fourth,
but
is
just
that
assume
every...
that was dicta.
Okay. Let me give you.
I'm just asking a common sense question. If you know that your intent to harm a suspect gives you liability for the suspect, common sense, you're not necessarily on notice that you're then on the hook for everything that happens, right? It's kind of this weird, it's like those tort standards about proximate cause and all those things. You're not necessarily knowing that.
Sure. That's an interesting question because the district court in McGowan went through why it doesn't matter because at common law, once you show malicious and intentional intent, because of the wanton nature of that intent, that person knows that the risk of injury to everyone for that conduct is super high. And so you expect, and the common law shows, that you will be liable for all those actions. It's like if I took a gun into a crowd and I just start shooting am I going to say, well, I didn't know I was going to hit these three people? Well, no. With the act of being so wanton to just open fire in the middle of a crowd, you expect to be liable and on notice. And the other,
it does seem like a reasonable rule. I agree. I just, the question is notice. How is an officer supposed to know that? Well, I mean, they don't. I presumably they don't.
Let me just. Law. I'm just one second. I'm just going to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 circuits I cited to that all said once you meet purpose to harm standard, that there's no qualified immunity for you because of the very nature of the burden. No reasonable officer would think that I can purposely harm someone unrelated to an
officer. The obvious rule?
Like Hope V. Pelzer. Yeah. Does an officer need notice that they can see someone on the street, not like them, chase them down, beat them up, completely unrelated to a law enforcement objective, get back in their car and drive away? Do they need a case to tell them that? Of course not. Does an officer need a case to tell them that they can chain a guy to a pole in the middle of the prison yard like in Hope v. Pelzer and leave him without water?
Purpose to harm can't really be enough. So, like, let's imagine someone is driving toward a schoolyard of kids, and the only way to stop them is for the police officers to ram that car and kill the driver to stop them from hitting the schoolyard. That is purpose to harm, but it is a legitimate law enforcement purpose. So can you connect the dots for me about why this shocks the conscience when we know there is a purpose for the chase?
Sure. Because there was no object of arrest related to the harm.
Okay. I don't feel like arrest could be the
only thing. Or a legitimate government objective. They weren't chasing him to stop him from, like, so the reason why you initiate a chase is to stop someone, right? To keep them from doing unlawful behavior. In Lewis v. County of, Sacramento, it said that the
sorry, are you dividing your time? Because
we're good.
Okay.
Sorry. In Lewis v. County of Sacramento, the Supreme Court said, look, when the officer was chasing the motorcycle, it wasn't to induce lawlessness. It wasn't to terrorize or harm the motorcycle and cause him to drive more erratically. So, but in here we have that. So they didn't have a legitimate law enforcement objective. They weren't trying to make him stop. Because they didn't want him to stop, right? They would have turned on the lights and sirens and had him pulled over. They didn't want to.
Is that pled a fact? Is that?
Yeah.
It's pled that they didn't have an objective to stop him?
Yeah. It's a reasonable inference from no lights and sirens.
Where's that pled? I'm just wondering.
Well, so it's all reasonable inferences can be drawn from the factual allegations of complaint according to Twombly v. Iqbal.
Yeah, but you said, it says a ghost chase, right? A chase usually means you stop them.
He never stopped him. So let's take the totality of the circumstances, like Pearson versus Parson v.
Oswald. What was the what is the alleged purpose of the ghost chase then in this case?
To cause the person to die, which is what they which if it wasn't, when they saw this person, and this is just facts, this is just truth, when they saw the suspect crash into a taco truck, saw people being maimed. And hurt, a broken back, a son dying on the ground. They didn't stop. They didn't get out of the car. They didn't say, hey, is everyone okay here? They didn't take anyone to handcuffs. And even when they left the scene, and I'm just going to tell you, body camera confirms it, left the scene, double back, pretend like they weren't a part of it, got there. They didn't say, hey, this guy was out of control. He was a criminal suspect and he lost control and this is what happened. No, they continued to conceal. They didn't write a report. And they were commenting to each other, I hope he dies.
So we have to accept the inference that these officers randomly spotted this car and wanted him to die.
Correct. For being a part of an illegal car rally, which, yeah. And you know how you can accept that is because give me a reasonable explanation for why an officer who just caused a giant crash into the middle of a taco truck doesn't stop their vehicle.
Well, you just said they violated department policy.
Well, yeah, more than that, what's more, violating department policy or someone's life? A person literally lost their life.
Good people. It's just a very strong inference you'd like us to make on pretty bare bones.
I feel like it's more plausible that he was trying to punish a person for being a part of a car rally they don't like than it is
to kill them versus stop them.
Than it is to let a police officer to let someone die on the ground because they're afraid of getting written up for IA. That, to me, is a way, way bigger stretch of the imagination. He's going to get written up and get suspended as opposed to someone dies.
I mean, I know we're supposed to draw inferences in your favor, but you're saying that the fact of the chase was We have to assume that the purpose of the chase was to kill him rather than to stop him.
Yeah, because, and you know why you have to say that?
Yeah.
You don't have to assume it. You have to take the factual allegations that every single effort, every single piece of action that they did afterwards confirmed that they wanted him to die. They said he wanted him to die. They never reported it. They didn't stop their car. They didn't get out of their car. They didn't identify themselves as officers. They didn't turn on the sirens. They didn't turn on their lights. They didn't call for medical.
Can I ask, the complaint doesn't say how they caused the crash. Do you know? Or?
By chasing at high speeds, just the same way as in Checky V. Webb, chasing the guy at high speeds through thoroughfares, causing the dude to lose control, causing the man to lose control. Causing him to lose control. Why else are you turn on your lights and sirens if you want him to pull over?
But they didn't, like, ram him or anything like that.
We don't allege that they were rammed.
Okay.
And neither were they in Checky V. Webb, by the way.
The car thing that happened, sorry, I'm forgetting the word. It involves spinning out your car in traffic. Is that what happened?
The allegation is that they were there at a car rally where you spin
car
your
rally.
Car
thank you. That's what it is, though, right?
Yeah.
It's doing these 360s.
Yeah, but it's not necessarily they were doing it, but they were at one, and then people leave it, and these officers were not supposed to chase people that were leaving it because it causes situations like this. So when the person was leaving it, they suspected he was a part of it, meaning either he was watching it or that he had partaken in it. We really don't know, to be honest. But what we do know is that they didn't call it in, they didn't turn on their lights and sirens, and when the guy crashed into a bunch of people and broke the back of one woman, the other, her son dying on the ground, they slowed down to see it, watched it happen, knew that the suspect needed medical attention, and they deliberately didn't call it in, concealed it from everybody. What my inference from that is that if I'm an officer, even if I'm going to get in trouble, yeah, someone's life is worth more than a piece of paper saying that I shouldn't have chased a guy.
But then under your theory, they also intended to kill the bystanders too.
Yeah, because once they saw, no, I agree. Absolutely. Once you see the bystanders injured on the ground after a car ran into them, then you, like you said, you don't want anyone to catch you. So let the witnesses die with them.
Well, wait—is that part of your first claim or your second claim?
My second claim.
Because that's not—I don't think you really have an allegation that the chase, when it's engaged in, to hurt the bystanders.
No, it's more
the deliberate indifference second claim.
Correct.
Okay,
Your Honor.
And the motive would be to cover up the fact of a chase.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you. We're taking you over your time. We'll give the other side 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Let me get right at it then. To respond further to your question, Judge Mumite, the argument that because someone has a claim that's not subject to qualified immunity, any other person's claim from the same conduct would necessarily be stripped of qualified immunity protection, that is not the law, and the case law on that is cited in the reply brief at pages 14 to 15. It's called Barrera versus City of Woodland, and I will just read the last paragraph of a lengthy citation. As such, notice that one's actions violates the Fourth Amendment does not put one on notice that one's action violates the 14th Amendment. So in other words, there could be a claim made that's not subject to qualified immunity. That doesn't mean that the same conduct under a different legal theory isn't covered by qualified immunity.
So you're suggesting that the intent to harm the suspect doesn't necessarily encompass intent to harm, well, liability for the bystanders.
Exactly. The fact that the driver,
it's kind of
the fleeing.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your answer.
The fact that the driver could sue and make a 14th Amendment claim based on the allegation, which is simply that there was intent to harm the fleeing suspect, doesn't mean that the bystander is stripped of that the officer is stripped of qualified immunity if it's a bystander who files the lawsuit.
But what I was going to say about this analogy you're drawing is, I and there may be problems with this that other area of case law, but the other area of case law is because the claim is interference with a familial relationship, it's a different claim than just excessive force. So I don't know that the idea that two different claims could have two different standards answers this, because this would be not two different legal theory claims, wouldn't it?
They are different requirements it's analogous to the Barrera case, where there is, they would be on notice that they were violating somebody's rights. But if that somebody is different from the plaintiff, they're not on notice if the law is different as to the plaintiff. And in this case, it is different.
It's just weird, though, because in that case, in the situation of the family members, I mean, and those cases are odd, but the cases of the family members, the claim is about interference with familial relationships, so then you need some sort of intent to interfere, which implicates the family members. But this is an excessive force. Each, the bystander and the driver would both be making the same claim of excessive force, not a different theory claim.
They're both 14th Amendment due process claims, but because the allegation is that the intent was to harm the driver, under all these cases that are cited in the briefs, which I won't go into now, that is not sufficient for a bystander claim.
The difference would be that the bystanders were injured primarily because of the negligence of the officers intending to harm the suspect. I don't accept that the complaint properly says that the officers had an intent to harm the bystanders. So, and then there's case law saying negligent, like, harm caused by officers is not, you don't have liability for that.
Not under the 14th Amendment. That's right. It's beyond even deliberate indifference. It's the highest standard of intent to harm. The plaintiff who wants to avoid qualified immunity is required to identify the case that it clearly establishes the unlawfulness of the conduct or the right that was violated. And the case that he mentions is Chachi versus Webb, which is a 1986 case, whereas the Lewis 14th Amendment jurisprudence is much later than that. Obviously, it's cited in that case. The case cited in Lewis, Fifth Circuit case, is a case that the actual holdings were about statute of limitations and proper venue. The dictum was not even the issue in this case. The dictum was the court stated that police engaging in a high-speed chase could be liable for emotional distress damages even without physical injury if the chase was inspired by malice towards the occupants of the fleeing vehicle. And that's not a proposition that has been endorsed by the Supreme Court or by this court.
Okay, you're over your rebuttal time, so I think I need to cut you off. Thank you for your helpful arguments. Thanks, both sides. This case is submitted, and we're adjourned for the day.